When can it be okay to copy? The answer to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. So, I'm a big fan of pro wrestling. That's why last year, when I created a fan tribute to Macho Man Randy Savage set to the music of Prince, I immediately uploaded it to YouTube. A week later, I received a note from YouTube in my email inbox saying, quote, "We have removed or disabled access to the following material as a result of a third-party notification claiming that your material is infringing," unquote. Infringing? Imagine my feelings of betrayal. I wasn't just copying, I was creating. I just thought I was making a creative contribution honoring one of my childhood heroes. Who exactly do my memories belong to, and why can't I make something creative with them? Of course, the story I just told is completely fictional, but that same scenario has happened thousands of times over, as media creators have been slapped with takedown notices citing the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. In some cases, though, creators actually can legally remix or reappropriate copyrighted material. That's where the Code of Best Practices in Fair Use for Online Video comes in. The Center for Social Media at American University's School of Communication released this set of guidelines last year to help inform online media creators of their rights when copyrighted material pops up in their work. In certain cases, like when the copyrighted material is used as an example, or just happens to be captured accidentally, media creators have actually been able to get their content back online. Fair use is still a confusing concept to unpack, and the Center for Social Media has just released a helpful video called Remix Culture, Fair Use is Your Friend, which you can find linked to on our website. I spoke to Patricia Ofterheide, the director of the Center for Social Media and one of the instigators behind the Code of Best Practices for Fair Use, to help us figure out how the code came about and where it's going.
We watched the online video environment be created almost overnight. In 2005, YouTube is created, and suddenly material that has been in hiding one way or another for years and years starts to bloom online. Suddenly a new practice in the world is created of these homemade videos that often, whether they want to or not, incorporate elements of popular culture. In some cases, people are very, very overt. They're doing remixes and mashups on purpose. In some cases, they don't even think about it. You know, there's this one famous video of the cat watching television. And it's funny because the cat's sitting there watching television like a middle-aged guy in a Barca lounger. But he's actually watching television, so you can hear all the audio from the television, all of which is copyrighted. You have the woman whose child dances to the tune, to a Prince tune, and she isn't even thinking about the fact that the Prince tune is copyrighted. She thinks it's really funny the way her kid her little toddler is dancing. So you've got a lot of different uses of copyrighted material that are showing up online. At the same moment we saw this happening, of course, so did the large content holders. Once YouTube was sold to Google, making it now a property that it was worth somebody's bothering to sue, Viacom then files a lawsuit against Google for copyright infringement, because there is a lot of copyrighted material on YouTube. And some of it is this newly created stuff, and some of it is last night's Comedy Central routines fully taken and uploaded onto YouTube simply in order to share them, which in fact is a case of infringement. And what we thought was that this was a dangerous moment for the future of this unique new creative form. Trying to get the legitimate infringement off could impair the future of work that was non-infringing, actually, that is a legitimate exercise of people's fair use rights. Lots of people are making it, and anybody could be doing it. There isn't any coherent, consistent creative group you can point to that is defending its interests in a national organization. We created the Code of Best Practices first by doing a survey of thousands of online videos that use copyrighted material, and we categorized the use of those materials with the help of our American University law students and School of Communication students. They tell us that this was the most fun job they ever did for money, combing through all kinds of video sites. We then went to a combined committee. We put those people together both on conference calls and virtually over 4 months, and we had them talk to each other about these different categories of use. The lawyers, understandably, were coming from a more traditional analog world. The cultural studies people were coming from a world where really anything goes and you don't even care about the law. And we created what we think is an extremely durable code of best practices in fair use for online video.
You've got cases, like you said, where there are people who are uploading full non-original work, and then you've got cases where people are just excerpting in new and creative ways. And of course, there's people who are uploading original work who believe that this is okay. What is the counterpoint to the code of best practices that you develop? Is there an industry response that says, no, you know, there's no reason that anybody should use copyrighted material in any way?
We had the people who were loudly vocal in the content industry always in our mind. And we wanted to make sure that the rights of ordinary people to make ordinary comments about their ordinary culture were preserved, while at the same time staying very strictly within the law. And when we released that document, we did not receive any criticism from any legal outlet anywhere at any content organization. There's one organization that I think is called the Copyright Alliance, where a non-lawyer who's a PR expert who's paid by the content industries to represent their issues from a public relations perspective, said that he thought that people who would use this could put themselves at risk. And he received such a calling out from Bill Patry, who is one of Google's main lawyers, but who before he was one of Google's main lawyers was the plaintiff in a fair use suit that he himself lost. And he was on the anti-fair use side of this lawsuit, and he lost, and he really saw the way in which fair use is a really vital, vibrant part of the law, and later became one of Google's lead counsels.
And the distribution online, the companies that do distribution online, such as YouTube, they also offer some methods for the industry to challenge cases in which they feel their copyright has been violated. You know, if it's in YouTube's case, the audio swap option, for instance, if somebody has, you know, a Prince song playing in the background, you know, they can swap it out if they've been given a takedown notice or something like that. And in some cases, people have just had their content taken down with no other option. I mean, what is the option for a content creator who has used a portion of copyrighted work in their work?
You know, the online service providers for video made a deal when the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was created. And the online service providers everywhere, not just for video, said, if we agree to take offending material down within 24 hours, we want a clause in there that says that we do not have any secondary liability. We will not also be culpable for any copyright mistakes made on our services because we're just a platform. So what YouTube has to do by law is if somebody like Viacom complains that there's copyrighted material on something, they have to take it down. But the person who had it has to be notified and has the right to file a claim, a counter takedown, something that says, no, really, I used this legitimately. And we think that that's where also the Code of Best Practices and Fair Use for Online Video is very handy, because you can, if you do have your material taken down, then you can go to the code and say, well, did I fair use this? That's my argument. I'm going to ask them to put it back up. Of course, if you do that, you make yourself eligible for that copyright holder to sue you. So you have to make sure that you think you're right. It is unfortunate about the takedown, counter takedown, because a lot of the takedown notices are not really done by people. They're done by automatic systems that detect copyrighted material and don't discriminate between fair uses and infringement.
Do you think there'll ever be a point where someone uploading something to YouTube can just check a box and say whether it fits into one of the main categories of what you guys define as fair use?
You know, know, I think it would be really wonderful if the online video providers generally, and of course YouTube provides 80% of all the online video, if the providers made this code available in their copyright practices section, and whenever there was a takedown notice, that they provided that information in their notice of takedown. I just think that would be great. As for a checkoff, I think the problem is always that fair use is one of those contextual things. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on your being able to say, did I use this copyrighted material for some other purpose than the original? And did I only use enough to really match that other purpose? So it's tough to, I suppose you could check a box that said, yes, I believe that is true. But it's also really important for everybody who uses that material to actually think about it. And I don't think that's too much to ask. I think every single time we open our mouths in public, we run through a mental checklist of what's appropriate and what's not. We take a look at who's around us. Are we speaking to our peers? Are we speaking to our grandparents? Are we speaking to students? Is this a sales presentation? And we accommodate our language appropriately, and we do make calculations every day about what's the right way to use our freedom of speech. And I don't think it's really any different for fair use. So I'm not sure it's going to be reduced to a checklist, and I think if it were reduced to a checklist, we really might lose the enormous flexibility and utility of this feature of the law. But I think this code of best practices is a document with a relatively short life. I think that as this practice gets more refined within several years, as more people do it, as more businesses made out of it, as traditional content businesses move into this environment more aggressively, the norms will change. And as the norms will change, we'll need somebody to do a new code of best practices too.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Dan, and best of luck with everything.
Patricia Afterheide is the director of the Center for Social Media at American University's School of Communication. You can follow the Center for Social Media at www.centerforsocialmedia.org. You can also find links to the Center for Social Media's recent video and the Code of Best Practices at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.